Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup for September 23rd, 2020. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today on the Roundup, we're going to be taking a look at three important questions we're hearing from international educators over the last 7 days. Today is a great day for me personally at SMIE Consulting. We held yesterday the second of our two UWC virtual visit days, where we were connecting 48 U.S. Universities and colleges with 19 United World College students, secondary school students, 19 school students around the world, and had an opportunity to bring together nearly 1,000 people over 2 days, September 1st and yesterday, September 22nd, together in virtual presentations through Zoom, followed by 2 hours of a college fair with students and counselors able to visit the different 48 different universities that were represented at the fair. So a big weight off my shoulders with that, those two events successfully completed yesterday. And that influences some of our questions today, which we'll get to in just a moment. For those of you that are new to the Midweek Roundup, this is our opportunity every Wednesday to go a little bit more in depth into some of the major news stories we've seen in our news feeds over the last few days and give our perspective on how these issues can be used efficiently and effectively on your own college campuses as they impact your own international education strategies, both on admissions and study abroad side, but primarily on the admissions side. So today, for those of you who have not been before, every Wednesday we take a look at these three questions that we're dealing with, different questions each week. And we find the majority of our questions from looking at our news stories that come out. We put together a newsletter as well called All the SMIE News Fit to Share. And if you don't know, SMIE stands for Social Media and International Ed Consulting. And that's a company I founded in 2014. To help put together universities and students overseas with partnerships and other services to make their international education plans and dreams reality. So this newsletter starts each Monday at 9 a.m. It's packed full of about 6 or 7 social media news stories, as well as international ed news stories, about 20 to 30, depending on the week. And it gives our opportunity to give our hot takes on what these topics mean and how they might be impacting what we do in international education. And then three of those stories we take a look at more in depth in the form of questions and try and provide some answers to those questions that might better serve you in your individual offices in colleges and universities around the country. So that's the format today. We're going to jump right into the first question, which is, how can you best connect virtually with international students? And I referenced the college fairs that we put on the September 1st and September 22nd yesterday for international students who are attending United World Colleges. These are secondary schools in 19 countries around the, or 18 countries around the world, where high ability kids, particularly in the last 2 years, are in an IB program, IB diploma program, really accelerated academic program that gets them well prepared for university study in the U.S. And we connect them with U.S. institutions that are part of the UWC Davis Foundation that are committed to awarding aid, substantial chunks of aid to international students who attend these schools, come on from these UWC schools, that come on scholarship to the United States, and the Davis Foundation pays for a certain portion of the students' expenses, and the individual institutions cover the rest, because many of these students are high ability, low ability to pay, high academic ability, low financial ability. So oftentimes they wouldn't be able to attend a U.S. college or university without this combined resources of the Davis Foundation, as well as the U.S. colleges that are willing to extend combinations of academic merit and need-based aid to these outstanding students. So these events over the last over these 2 days, we connected over 1,000 students and counselors with these 48 colleges and universities through these virtual events. We had an hour-long introductory session with three major presentations on need-based financial aid, on the importance of essays in the application process and U.S. campus life, and much of these in through the lens of COVID-19 and other issues that are impacting on what we do in the United States. And we were able to have these two events that went off without a hitch in the opening hours, and then followed with 2 hours of college fair time for the students to meet individually with their colleges and university representatives. So this is, for lack of a better way, better word, it's the way. It is the way that the majority of institutions are able to connect with new prospective students that they don't already have relationships with. Lead generation tools like ListBuys from SAT and ACT have kind of gone out the window this year with the lack of tests that have been able to be offered. Similarly, in the spring, there were issues impacting TOEFL and IELTS students' ability to take those exams, which have fairly mostly resolved now, but there are still certainly challenges on that front. So a lot of the lead generation tools that U.S. colleges and universities that relied on physical travel to generate those leads for them, to then nurture through their admissions communication flow, those have disappeared this year, certainly internationally. And that's something that we are, those that have typically done physical tours and physical travel. I was originally going to be arranging travel for all of September, 2 weeks in Asia, 2 weeks in Europe for U.S. Davis Foundation schools to visit these UWC schools in Europe and Asia. And we weren't able to do that this year, so we quickly pivoted to do this virtual event. And there's a lot of negative press recently over what virtual events are looking like. A lot of vendors that have been doing physical tours have had to make the switch just to keep things going, because there's certainly an interest in continuing relationships with institutions and students, and how do those relationships best fit. My particular organization is fairly niche. It's a specific set of schools connecting to a specific group of universities. So there's more in common between those than perhaps the general affairs that are going on here. But when you look at organizations like NACAC, and we'll take a look at what they've done a couple weeks ago related to their first virtual fair this year and what that looked like, and some of the technical glitches that happen. But an organization that traditionally puts on these massive in-person events at large convention centers really around the country and even into Canada over the last couple of few years. These big events, the transition from in-person to a virtual is never seamless. And it's one that's fraught with a lot of potential pitfalls and challenges as you put together the organizational pieces. You figure out bandwidth issues and capacity issues, which is one of the challenges that NACAC faced. But you also look at how students can really connect best with universities and colleges in this virtual world that we're all been flung into the middle of when it comes to this student recruitment cycle. And what NACAC experienced is they had, their first fall, first college fair on the 14th, or actually the 13th, just looking at the dates, the 13th of September. And when the website opened for the fair, the site was overwhelmed due to a massive volume. This is from Angel Perez, the new CEO of NACAC, due to a massive volume of students trying to log on at the same time. So I ended up with having over 20,000 students register, many at the last minute, and it basically crashed the site. So the company fixed it within an hour, and students had access for the remaining portion of it. And in this article, Inside Higher Ed article that I'm dropping the link into the comments section on our Facebook page, it's certainly there's some criticism in there, most notably from a colleague at Platform Q, formerly College Week Live, that was very critical of that effort, saying that these kinds of events, virtual events for universities to connect with students, are wrong. Individual face-to-face visits via Zoom with individual schools and college fairs, virtual fairs, is that it's creating, he says, are creating experiences that will result in a lot of effort with hard to prove results. And I think that's a little off base because, frankly, having worked at College Week Live, certainly back in the day in the early teens, this was the way. This was their way at the time. And I worked with them, consulted with them for a couple of years before having which worked with them when I was at Education USA on setting up the large international student days that were successful from 2010 to 2015 and or so. And those events have resulted in connecting virtually universities with international students and that were overseas. And it's an opportunity to really start the process. And it was a lead gen source for many institutions. And that's frankly, College Week Live has really de-emphasized that portion of it. Now Platform Q Education have de-emphasized the virtual lead gen events, the public facing events in their overall work over the last few years because they've seen declining results in terms of international students coming to events and following through with institutions. And they focus their work primarily on the private events, event platforms that allow institutions to reconnect with student prospects that are already in their database. So that certainly is very much a part and should be a part of every institution's international education or international admissions planning is having that virtual component for re-engagement. And I certainly applaud what Platform Q Education has done. But I certainly don't agree that virtual events can't work because it really depends on how well they're organized and frankly the format and the platforms that are used to really connect them. And as much as people will denigrate Zoom for what it can do and what it can't do and the Zoom fatigue that people feel, it really depends on how well you use it because we had outstanding responses from counselors and students to our first hour presentations and the connections that were had in Zoom rooms where it was video, where students and were able to ask questions directly of other current students that were attending those campuses and or admissions folks. That opportunity to have that live interaction has to be able to replace the in-person when it doesn't exist currently. And that is, if that's the first point of contact, to have a lead generation tool that allows you that one-on-one interaction or one-to-small group interaction as a international admissions representative, why wouldn't you want to do that? And not all virtual fairs are set up that way. Mostly it's live chat, and that's it, not video. But we were able to do that with our events using Zoom, and it worked quite well. And the student responses from the first event gave it a 4.4 out of 5 rating. So they were clearly excited with the opportunity to connect and to have the interaction directly with the international admissions people and current students who were part of those conversations in the virtual rooms. So and that's video conversations too. So that I think makes a difference. You can't obviously do that with 20,000 students connecting with institutions all at once. So that's clearly not feasible in this day and age, given the technology and bandwidth issues that are out there. But if it's a focused event and managed well, it can truly be a success. So that's really is finding that balance and getting it right is certainly a piece of the puzzle. But one of the things that we did in preparation for these virtual events that we did with our United World College students and the universities involved is we had the colleges, this was back in July, we set it up where we asked the colleges to do a 90-second kind of elevator pitch, elevator speech to prospective students to convince them, hey, come and join us. I asked them to encourage them to make reference to the UWC students you have on campus, reference that as part of your pitch, because this is a specialized custom event for UWC students. So encourage them not to use kind of general promotional videos they already had in place for connecting with these students. But there were some really positive examples that came out of this. Some institutions did a great job in simple ways of just doing it with iPhones and recording themselves, recording current students involved in that were alumni of these UWC schools overseas to be a part of the pitch. And that led to really some significant traffic on the day for those institutions. So those pitches made a difference. And so these This is something I see real value in this virtual world of being able to connect students and institutions together is where there is that opportunity for the video engagement as well as just being able to listen and take in information that's necessary to help inform decisions. But related to this is in terms of how we can best connect virtually with international students, the main question. Another company in one of our UWC colleges that was involved in the program is also involved in this, where they, and actually several of them are, where they have a company called Initial View that has done, has initially done interviews with Chinese students that are looking to come to the United States, where they do, the Initial View records interviews with those students, and then those get sent along to the institutions that those students wish to apply to, as replacement for, typically supplemental to English test results like a TOEFL or an IELTS, but sometimes in place of that. And the initial interview concept that they've pioneered, and other companies have done this as well, they've now also added in an elevator pitch for the incoming class. So it's an opportunity for this to go both ways, both for students to record 90-second elevator pitches about themselves. That can be sent as sort of a virtual or a video essay or a video introduction to universities who might want to recruit them, and as well as for institutions to do similarly a 90-second elevator pitch video to connect with prospective students. So it's just kind of almost like a video meet and greets or virtual dating app for colleges and universities to connect with international students. So really interested to follow this story and or follow this product, and I'll drop the link from Initial View into the comments section here. But something really, really, I think this year and moving forward, I think can have a real add real value to the international student recruitment process. And no, I'm not getting paid by Initial View to drop their products into here, but the concept is certainly one I think has real value and as a way of connecting better students and colleges overseas. So moving on to our second topic, very much unrelated to the virtual connections with students, but certainly a topic. China is almost a never-ending topic when it comes to international education and the many facets of their own international education strategy in that country compared to what their students are experiencing in terms of barriers to entry and once they're here, the experiences they're having, challenges there, perceptions of the United States in China, all of those things. We've talked about those on the Roundup before. But this one caught my eye last week, and it's a story about from the National Association of Scholars, and this is when I read this article, it certainly made me aware of the relationship testing organizations have in certain countries, and how and I have friends who work at College Board who have been very much involved with rollout of College Board products in China. So this article kind of caught me by surprise as I read it, and it's referencing a relationship between College Board and the Chinese government. This is a report from the National Association of Scholars that's called Corrupting the College Board, Confucius Institutes and K-12 Education. And that documents since early 2000s, College Board has been partnering closely with the Chinese Communist Party to develop, and that's this may the language here certainly tells you that the organization probably has a more conservative bent to it because of the language that's used. They've worked with government agencies, in this case the Communist Party in China, to develop an AP Chinese language and culture course. They have served, the report claims that they've served as a recruiter for Chinese government initiatives to connect with the U.S. institutions, apparently, and helped the Chinese Communist Party design and gain control over American teacher training programs such as National Chinese Language Conference. In 2014, the College Board CEO David Coleman refer to the Hanban, the Chinese government agency that controls Confucius Institutes here in the United States, as the sun, whose light the College Board, the moon, was so honored to reflect. So obviously, the current CEO of College Board, David Coleman, no longer CEO, but I think he's still has a senior leadership role there. They're hoping, there's been talk of trying to unseat him, but certainly I'm not well positioned to know that, where that stands. But there's certainly rumblings about his leadership, and certainly this contributes to it, among other things, that the report claims how the College Board's close relationship with the Chinese government shows how deeply China has penetrated the American education system, says one of the senior research fellows there. Certainly in the U.S., we've seen related to the Confucius Institutes how much press they've gotten over the last couple 3 years, and certainly the closing down of over half the Confucius Institutes in the United States as a result of the lack of control U.S. institutions have over those Confucius Institutes on their campuses. The government here, State Department defining the Hanban in the U.S., the office that oversees them in D.C., as a mission of China, not just an educational institution. So where they're propagandizing China through these Confucius Institutes, and that's the nature of the beast for these institutes, frankly. The interesting recommendations that this report makes is replacing the AP Chinese language and culture test, requiring schools to close Confucius classrooms, requiring the College Board to cut ties with the Chinese government, investigate the College Board corruption, and replace the National Chinese Language Conference. So these are significant accusations and ones that I'm hearing about for the first time. And I did not know of this relationship. And colleagues of mine at work at College Board certainly will have their own responses to this. And I'm sure that they will. Well, I hope they would have their own responses to it, because they have had a very close relationship with China in getting SAT and AP classes offered throughout the country, and the ability to do that is under threat. But this report certainly talks of deeper levels of cooperation than certainly I was aware of, and that's perhaps is concerning to you. Maybe it isn't. I don't know, but certainly one to keep an eye on, and we will certainly monitor that going forward as well. So. Interesting to see that report. We'll again keep you posted if we get any other responses to it or feedback from College Board on it. Now, finally, I want to go down under to Australia. And months ago, in the middle of the pandemic, in over the summer months, it looked like Australia was going to be able to reopen for their spring term this summer. Our late summer, be able to reopen for international students this fall, our fall, their spring, with a pilot project for the federal territories there around Canberra, where there was going to be a pilot project of 200 to 300 students. This was actually designed to have continuing students, international students come back to Canberra. But that was delayed after a second wave of coronavirus hit Melbourne. There was another new partnership as a result late August with South Australia to bring 300 students, returning students. But there's some delays on that as well. Because they're not really sure what the final logistics are going to be yet. But in the end, we've already talked last week about what's happened in New Zealand or in other midweek roundups recently. New Zealand has had probably the best success in managing a coronavirus, hasn't had any new native-born cases of coronavirus for 2-3 months now, and is basically clean of COVID. But they've been very cautious in reopening, and in fact made the decision to not reopen for this calendar year. They are in the midst of an election, presidential election there, prime minister election there, and that has basically put on hold any changes to policy which currently say no international students can come. So they, a smaller country, obviously New Zealand, but certainly a major destination for international students. So they haven't been able to admit new students or have returning students come back in New Zealand. And that has obvious financial implications when 15% of their institutions, higher ed institutions, the eight universities and other polytechnics are 15% are international and pay higher fees. In Australia, this article, the title of the article is really inflammatory and it's kind of nonsensical, but it says, "Let the international student sector burn," with an exclamation point. But what's happened is, as a result of Australia closing down in February, March, when they made the decision to basically not open borders because of travel restrictions due to COVID, they closed their borders to any incoming students and other visitors, obviously, at the end of February, which is right at the beginning of their year. In 2019, there were, in February, at the start of the year, there was 183,900 students. That went down to 121,320. In March, they normally had 72,000 in 2019. That went down to 60,000. Then in April, May, June, and July, they go down from 44,000, 34,000, 26,000, 143,000 in those 4 months, as was 2019's figures, to less than 170 new international students came in the country in 4 months, in April through July. So they have lost out on, if you add up those numbers, that's 78,000 plus 190,000. So we're talking in those 4 months last year, they had well over 260,000 international students enter the country for study, 260,000 students. You went from 260,000 in 4 months last year, April through July, to less than 200 in that same time period. So, wow, that is completely changing the game for Australian higher education. Which is in terms of the major destination markets, it's the most dependent on international students as a percentage of their student bodies. 25-30% is the average there, and also they pay that higher rate. So financially, they are extremely dependent on those international student dollars. So those have basically been erased, and for the last 4 months. After a couple of down months, February, March, they have dropped. The bottom has dropped out of international students coming into the country. Now, given yes, there are students who are studying remotely from their home countries with the Australian institutions that might have ordinarily been able to start, and that is happening. So definitely, that is a saving grace for many of these institutions, but not all of these 260,000 that didn't enroll. Didn't physically come are all online. They've gone elsewhere. So it'll be interesting to see those numbers on once borders reopen, if they pick up, because those are their July is the single largest month in 2019, or after February, July was their next biggest cohort coming in. So 183,000 in February 2019, 143,000 in July 2019. And this July, they were down to 40 in July, new of international students that entered the country. So really, this is troubling because it's troubling for Australian higher ed, and they've taken a huge hit. There really hasn't been a lot of talk that I've seen on any of these news stories about Australia about a financial bailout. There's probably something, I would assume, that has to be going on there. But there are, frankly, a lot of ancillary industries in Australia that are connected, much like jobs in the United States, international student jobs on campus, but also jobs in the community that either are support what international students do or where international students have worked that are now going unfilled, much like what's happening in the U.S. this summer with J-1 employee employees that come in from overseas to do summer work in the summer coast and the coasts along the coast of the U.S. at theme parks and all these other things, beaches, hospital beaches, restaurants, entertainment industries that are bolstered have a lot of volume in the summer. First, the volume hasn't really been there, certainly as much as it has, but also those students were prevented from entering. Those J-1 exchanges were prevented from entering for summer work because of restrictions the government placed on entry. And that's happened, obviously, in Australia, too, and where it's affecting not only students, but also other factors of sectors of the Australian economy. So the lingering effects of what we're seeing with COVID-19 in terms of impacts on economies are going to be felt for months, if not years, to come. So what's this article, the macro business article, which does tend to be a fairly right-wing, fairly conservative business and not fully anti-international or things immigration like we have some news outlets here in the U.S. But the numbers certainly don't lie in terms of the number of students that haven't enrolled this fall. But you look at what's happening with in Australia, that and the second article I'll post also covers kind of the ancillary businesses that are impacted, housing industry in particular in the metropolitan areas, Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra, Perth even. You see a lot of that detail here where they're hugely impacted by the lack of international students. So we're talking about 260,000 international students that did not come to Australia to study between April and July. And we'll see how much longer that continues, maybe through to January again, much like New Zealand is doing. So we'll be keeping an eye on all of these for you and more as we move forward, as COVID continues to impact what we do in international education as well as our own lives. But we will certainly look forward to future conversations. Thanks again to those of you who are watching live on Facebook and also watching on repeat, on replay on our Facebook page or YouTube channel. And a big shout out to the podcast subscribers. And just a quick heads up, we are now live on Amazon Music. So if you get your podcast there, certainly you can subscribe to us on Amazon Music in addition to Google Play, iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, and Stitcher. So looking forward to chatting with you at future chats, midweek roundups, and looking forward to seeing you soon. All the best. Cheers.